Anger has been sparking protests all over the world in recent months. It can be a positive motivating force or destructive and damaging, especially when it goes unchecked. On this week's Please Explain, we are taking a look at the roots and consequences of anger with Dr. Philip Muskin, professor of clinical psychiatry at the Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Howard Kasanov, professor of psychology and director of the Institute for the Study and Treatment of Anger and Aggression, and author of Anger Management, the Complete Treatment Guidebook for Practitioners, also Anger Management for Everyone. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Philip, we all know anger when we feel it, but what is it? Is it emotional? Is it something physical, chemical in our bodies?
It's all three. It certainly has an emotional quality, and it varies from annoyed to rageful. There are physical concomitants to it. Probably everyone experiences it differently. You might feel it in your chest. You might feel it in your face or in your gut. And certainly there are circuits in our brain that are designed for fear, that are designed for anger. But I don't think we know whether animals experience anger. It's hard to ask them. But certainly animals experience fear, and fear and anger are closely connected, certainly in some people. So it's not in the ether. It's in all of us.
Well, you can see it when an animal gets angry. If you taunt a dog or a cat, they get a look in their eyes.
They certainly do. And the question is you know, we don't know what animals feel. Maybe some of the apes that we have taught how to speak through sign language or symbols can tell us. But I agree with you. Certainly, if you annoy an animal, it will react to you. But we don't know exactly what that animal is feeling. With a person can say, "You're making me angry." But we also know that some people will say they're angry, and because that's the only way they know how to express it. But that isn't exactly what they're feeling. They're frightened or they're depressed, but they express it in that way.
Howard, well, anger does have many negative associations, but can it also be constructive?
Well, there's no doubt that it is constructive. I mean, anger kind of motivates us to right wrongs, and anger motivates us to protect our property and our loved ones. It comes from our evolutionary past as part of the fight or flight reaction. And in that sense, in the past, it was very, very useful. The problem with anger is that now many of those responses are no longer useful. So just to take a small example, if you have two adolescents in school and one adolescent steals a book from the other, you don't have to kill the other adolescent. You don't have to maim the other adolescent. In the human world, we have better ways of taking care of that, such as the teacher or the police force or the clergy or parents, etc. But historically, it was very important for survival.
Well, some things, like when somebody steals your parking space, I don't want to talk about when somebody steals your book, it doesn't seem to faze some people. Others go ballistic. So why does anger affect people so differently? And sometimes on different days, one day you can just shrug something off. The next day, it might make you go crazy.
Well, absolutely. You know, we call anger in the Institute here a negative psychobiological response. And that definition would explain what you're asking. By the psychological part of it, we mean the thoughts that we have. So let's assume that somebody does take your parking place. You have two general ways of looking at that. This is unpleasant. This is unfortunate. Now I have to go looking for another one, and I'm going to be late for a meeting. And that cognitive response would lead to maybe annoyance or irritation. Or you could look at it as a catastrophe, the end of the world. How dare the other person do this? I can't take it anymore. I'm going to get even. Those kind of thoughts will lead to a much stronger response. So we can explain individual differences in anger by that cognitive difference. In terms of variations within a person, We also know that you're more likely to get angry if you're fatigued, if you've had something to drink, or if you use drugs, if you've previously had an argument with your wife or husband or friend, if you've had difficulties on the job. Those events will lead you to become more angry in response to, say, the parking spot loss, than on another day when the sun is shining and your wife have just planned a vacation and you've just gotten a raise, and then they steal your parking place. So what?
My guests are Howard Kasanov and Philip Muskin. We're talking about anger on today's Please Explain, and taking your calls at 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So, Philip, when does anger go from a normal reaction to a problem? Can anger be an indication that there are other psychological and emotional problems going on in a person?
Yeah, of course. As was just mentioned, when whatever it is external to us is interpreted as a threat, the person is more likely to respond in an angry way than if it's an annoyance. And I don't want to make a dichotomy there, but things that threaten us certainly capture that evolutionary quality that we're set up to protect ourselves or to run away. You know, we want to have lunch. We don't want to be lunch. So if we think we're going to be lunch, we are going to respond in kind. And that's how our ancestors, and when I say our ancestors, you can go back, you know, millions and millions and millions of years. That's how you survive. We have parts of our brain that are designed to do that. The amygdala, which gets talked about a lot, actually sees everything before the rest of the brain. That is, stuff that goes in through our eyes and our optic nerves makes its first stop at the amygdala. And the amygdala makes the decision, I'm going to run away, I'm going to attack. And then the rest of the brain gets a chance to decide on that. So if you perceive something as a threat, then obviously you're going to respond that way. But what could cause that to happen? One thing that could cause that to happen is you've been in danger in the past. When we talk about people who come back from combat and they have post-traumatic stress disorder, they hear a helicopter, and when I hear a helicopter, I look around to see it because I like to look at airplanes. They may have a very different response. They interpret it as a threat. If the parking spot, it comes on a day when you feel rushed and pressured and you have to get somewhere, it's going to feel very different than in a day you're just driving around, it's a nice day. And those things are actually biological. We talk about them psychologically, but of course they're biological as well. There are circuits in our brains. So to answer your question directly, there are obviously people who have trouble controlling their impulses, and that's not just one thing. If you're very depressed, you may not be only sad sitting at home in a dark room. You may get angry very, very quickly because everything feels like a threat to you. If you're intoxicated with any one of a variety of substances, those drugs act on the brain and make you much more likely to respond inappropriately. And I think we all agree that responding with anger to many situations is inappropriate, though there certainly are times it's appropriate, and it is a positive motivator for change. Because one thing about anger is it's quite unpleasant, and you want to change the situation, and it can be a great motivator for change.
Well, sometimes we see it go way to extremes. So there is a recent news story here, not the first time this has ever happened, where a man killed an infant with a pipe, in this case. I don't know if that's anger or if that's an expression of something else.
Well, you know, children, if you have had children, can be very frustrating. They cry. You can't always figure out what's going on and how to make them stop crying. It can be very frustrating, and you see how that can, in some circumstances, push someone to respond in an angry way. Now, that isn't what Dr. Spock recommends, of course. Dr. Spock recommends trying to figure it out and taking some deep breaths and trying to reassure your baby. And not everybody can do that. And they're just, they're not equipped to do that. Add on to that varieties of mental illness, and you can see how someone might respond very inappropriately. We could say the same thing about road rage. I mean, big deal, so someone cut you off. But we well know that people will chase someone at 100 miles an hour, endanger their lives and everyone else's, because they got cut off.
Right. You know, Leonard, I wanted to comment, if I can, about, you said, is this anger or is it aggression? And I want to make sure that everybody understands that anger is this different phenomenon from aggression. I certainly agree with Philip that often we don't know what animals are feeling in the sense that they can't talk to us. We know that they behave aggressively because we can observe that over and over again. But in our studies, what we found is that anger, which has these components of ideas about how bad things were, ideas about wanting revenge, and aggression, which is the motor behavior of hitting or pushing or shoving or killing or knifing and stabbing, you know, in our studies, only 10% of anger events are actually followed by motor aggression. But most motor aggression is preceded by anger. So when people look in the newspapers and they see that someone has been murdered by a lover, or the event that you just gave about a child who was hurt by a parent, there often is frustration and anger before that that leads up to the event. But lots of anger, for most of us, just occurs as a separate phenomenon.
A listener in Brooklyn left this comment on our show page. I took a philosophy class on anger when I was in college, and the professor said that anger was a positive force and an expression of self-esteem, and that we get angry at those who are somehow treating us worse than we feel we should be treated. One would have no reason to become angry if we if you had low self-esteem, don't feel worthy of respect or consideration. But it seems to me people with low self-esteem are often the ones who get angriest.
Actually, that's not what we find. It's the people with high self-esteem who become angry. In other words, if you're in a job and you don't think much of yourself, and the boss says to you, you're not doing a good job, you know, you better work harder or you're going to get fired, you may say to yourself, well, you know, I understand because I don't think much of myself anyhow. But if you have high self-esteem and you say to yourself, I'm the best contributor to this company, they're lucky to have me, and then the boss says to you, you know, you're really not contributing, then you're likely to get on your high horse and say, you know, what's going on here? You don't appreciate me, and become angry. So it's really high self-esteem that leads to anger, not low self-esteem.
Let's take some calls, okay? Our first Great. Caller is John from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. You know, I was wondering if there's any information about whether there's a genetic component to anger or if it's really more based on nurture. So the reason I'm asking you this is I know a family where everybody is angry in that family all the time, and they don't seem to be able to control it. Anyway, I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for calling us.
Philip, I'll take a shot at it. I think that certainly there is variation in the human nervous system in terms of responsiveness to external stimuli. That variation is genetically determined. So I would expect that there's a large genetic component. I also would expect that generally there's a large biological component because, as I said before, it's part of our evolutionary past.
And of course, I agree completely. And then there's that's the nature part, and there's a nurture part. If you grow up in a family where everyone screams at each other and loses their temper, there are two possibilities. You grow up to think that that's the way people express themselves, and that seems usual. It may not seem normal, but it's familiar. Or you grow up exactly the reverse. you are constantly trying to suppress that in yourself because it was so painful when you grew up. And people, of course, grow up, and you're absolutely right, we inherit so much. Think about your children and how consistent they seem to be almost from birth in certain kinds of temperaments. And they grow up to be adults who are very much like they were as babies. But you also see people, the best example that I see in therapy is patients who will say, I think of what my mother would have done, and then I do the exact reverse, and I'm almost always right.
Let's take another call. Pavel from Norwalk, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, well, any chemicals like neurotransmitters are involved? Like, for example, serotonin or dopamine are making us happy and pumping in our reward area of the brain. And another thing, your example about high esteem, does it mean that our alpha instinct and certain people, some people have higher alpha instinct than others, if they don't get satisfaction of this, that's where they are getting angry because they don't have enough dopamine in their reward area of the brain?
Doctors?
Well, I wish it was that simple. Actually, all the neurotransmitters are involved. Dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. I think it would be, at this point in what we know, hard to say it's one or the other. Though I will mention a study that was done years ago where they gave fluoxetine, which we know commonly as Prozac, to people who were not depressed. And what the people said was they felt a lot calmer when they were taking fluoxetine. Things bothered them much less. So clearly, neurotransmitters are involved. These are very important chemicals in our brain. But the reality is it isn't too much or too little per se. These are very subtle fluctuations in a sense of how the brain talks to itself and how these circuits work.
Well, sometimes people who have suffered brain trauma or who have Alzheimer's disease become angrier than they once were. Is there a region of the brain that's damaged in those kinds of cases?
Well, as we know from Phineas Gage, who is very important, and everyone who's at their computer right now I know is Googling Phineas Gage. But Phineas Gage was a very responsible manager on the railroad, and one day a tamping rod went through his eye, through his brain, and basically gave him a frontal lobotomy. And Phineas Gage then became basically a ne'er-do-well. Right? He was not responsible. He drank. He caroused. He lost his temper all the time. That is, the connection between the front of our brain, our prefrontal cortex, and the rest of the brain is very important. In Alzheimer's disease, the disease really does involve the whole brain, but what is basically happening is the way the brain talks to itself is destroyed in Alzheimer's, and so impulsivity, sudden anger, frustration. I mean, imagine, you know, being 75 years old and having really worked very hard in your life, and things just don't make any sense anymore. That can make you very frustrated and can cause these sort of flashes of anger. And this is also true in some people who suffer from traumatic brain injuries. That is, the destruction of one part of the brain affects the entire brain. You know, we like to localize things, and you see all those beautiful pictures, but the brain really is always working together all the time.
My guests are Dr. Philip Muskin, who's professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center, Dr. Howard Kasanov, who's professor of psychology and director of the Institute for the Study and Treatment of Anger and Aggression. Let's go to another call. Bill from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. The previous caller kind of pulled the wool out from my question, but I will try to rephrase it. At the risk of sounding as an oversimplification, would you say that the two primary neurotransmitters associated with, respectively, anger versus fear would be noradrenaline is more associated with anger and fear is more associated with adrenaline or epinephrine?
Well, you know, when we get excited, be it angry or we need to run or we're afraid, our body pumps out both norepinephrine or noradrenaline and epinephrine, both in the brain and peripherally, because these chemicals have different effects in the brain. They do one thing. They stimulate our heart to beat faster. They raise our blood pressure. They change our blood vessels. They actually prepare us to fight or flee. They're both involved, and that contributes also to the effects some people get from medications or from illicit substances. That is, those things can cause it, but it isn't strictly speaking. And I hate when we try to so localize things to chemicals, because I think it's too reductionistic. People are so much more complex than the chemicals in their brains. On the other hand, if you get a shot of adrenaline, you're likely going to feel more stimulated, though there's research from 40 or so years ago where they actually gave people shots of adrenaline or epinephrine, and their response to the chemical completely depended upon context. If they were sort of sitting around lounging with Indian music playing and everyone was very mellow, they felt mellow. And if everybody was very upset, they felt upset. So those kinds of studies suggest to us that we're just not as simple as our chemicals. And I think that Howard made that clear, that this is psychological, but of course we're biological creatures, so it isn't in the ether.
I agree, and you know, I think we like to simplify. What we'd like to find is one chemical, or one hormone, or one neurotransmitter, and as that increased in our body, people became more and more angry, and that would solve the problem.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that's not the case.
And that would also lead to a perfect cure for anger management. It would allow us to simply take something that would prevent that thing from surging through our body. But that's not going to happen either. Ron, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lopez. It was a pleasure to hear your show. My question is, how much of anger is tied into the bipolar illness, manic depression? Is that a root for the illness, or is the illness mask the anger?
We have a number of patients in our institute here at Hofstra who also have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And, you know, my answer to that is that anger is not recognized as an independent disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Rather, anger is a component of a wide variety of other disorders. And so when the people come into us for treatment, they often may be diagnosed as bipolar, or may be diagnosed with general anxiety disorder, or may be diagnosed with something else. But the exact linkage between these diagnoses is unclear for us.
Howard, you've written a number of books on anger management.
I have. That's correct.
Well, listeners are calling about things like children's temper tantrums, for example, how do you get a kid to manage his or her anger?
You let them grow up.
You just wait it out. But, okay, so here I am. I'm somebody who finds himself overwhelmed by my anger. Somebody pushed me in the subway. Instead of just letting it go, I make a remark. The other person gets really angry with me, and the next thing I know, I'm being punched in the mouth.
Well, you know, let me answer your question by introducing the word dysregulation. If anger is part of who we are, as we grow from young children through adulthood, the idea is for us to learn how to regulate its frequency, its intensity, and its duration so that we can become productive members of society. We'll never get rid of it, because it is useful and it sometimes is reinforced, but we have to learn how to regulate it. That's the job of parents, teachers, the religious institution, friends, etc. I agree with, again, what Philip said before. If you grow up in a family where the mother and father are screaming and yelling and the older brother is hitting the younger sister, and you're observing that, you're not going to learn how to regulate your anger very well. If you're watching, and we're concerned about this, if you're watching cartoons where one cartoon figure is constantly running after another one, hitting that one on the head. If you're playing video games, which are basically violent, you are not learning how to regulate your anger to become a productive citizen.
But aren't there people who also will tell you that if you repress your anger, that will make you ill? If you hold everything in, there was a time when people were encouraged to have a punching bag,
right,
or something to take care of the anger, although I think I read a study that suggested that if you punch the punching bag a lot, you're likely to punch the person next to you as well.
Absolutely. I put out a book in 1995 called Anger Disorders, and what surprised me, it was an edited book, that 8 out of the 8 people who wrote the book with me as editors all agreed that the punching bag, this notion that we call catharsis, letting it out, was not a good idea, because what you were learning to do was to punch more efficiently. You say people have said it's no good to hold it in. It's no good to hold it in, and it's no good to punch it out. The solution is verbal assertion. In other words, if you're having a problem with somebody, the idea is to be able to say, look, Charlie, I'm feeling very uncomfortable and very unhappy with what's going on between you and me right now. I'd like to talk to you about it, if that's possible. In other words, to communicate with the other person in an assertive way, letting that person know what your feelings are, what your desires are. So we're not advocating holding it in, but nor are we advocating punching it out.
Now, we have very little time, maybe 30 seconds, but a listener in Chapel Hill wonders about the role of the Internet and anger, because people seem to write the most hurtful things on impulse. Is it freeing people to express their anger in a way that they might have in the past?
I would say one thing about the Internet is because you're not sitting with the person or standing in front of the person, as Howard just said, it makes it a lot easier to express things in this very aggressive way, which I think we all agree isn't a good idea. And it's distant. You're really just typing things. There's no person who looks at you and says right away, What are you saying? It's so impersonal that I think it makes it possible for people to express things in this inappropriate way.
Dr. Philip Muskin is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Howard Casanova, professor of psychology and director of the Institute for the Study and Treatment of Anger and Aggression at Hofstra. Thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Well, thank you.
And thank you very much.
On Monday's show, Yale University's Vikram Mancharamani explains how he thinks we can spot the next economic bubble and even know when it'll burst. And then our update on the ongoing protests sweeping throughout the Middle East. Also, David Bezmoskis discusses his debut novel, The Free World, that examines the lives of Soviet Jews who have escaped to Rome in 1978. Plus, technological advances now make it possible for us to have verbal conversations with computers. Brian Christian joins us to help us explore what speaking with a program could tell us about human nature. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer. We had help today from William Meismer. Dimitri Krosny, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaacs were at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.